conversations that you connect with and react to. SAFM.
Well, let me welcome onto the show our guests that are going to be a part of this conversation for the coming hour. Professor Louise Vincent is Professor of Political Studies at Rhodes University. Professor Louise, good morning to you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Professor Becky Ngomezulu is a Professor of Political Science and International Relations and also Director of the Center for the Advancement of Non-Racialism and Democracy at the Nelson Mandela University. Professor Ngomezulu, good morning.
Good morning, Ms. KP, and good morning to my fellow panelists.
And Dr. Oscar van Heerden is a Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Diplomacy and Leadership at the University of Johannesburg. Dr. van Heerden, good morning.
Good morning, Kathy. Good morning, panelists, and good morning to the listeners.
Well, thank you all for making time for this conversation. As we mark Freedom Month in this country, and in particular it being 30 years of this country's democracy, we kicked off the month with asking listeners, what does freedom mean to them? And it's really what has come out of those conversations that has steered the direction of the follow-up conversations we've been having. The one thing that has been clear is that for many people, their feeling of being free is directly associated or linked with their ability to access their rights. So if I live in an area where I'm not safe, I'm unable to access services such as running water or any other basic rights that are contained in the Bill of Rights, then I don't feel free. In fact, I don't believe that I am free. And so it became even more important to then say, well, what is the distinction between freedom and living in what is a participatory democracy like South Africa is? So that's why we've invited all of you to come onto the show today to hopefully help us make that distinction so that even if we're feeling that we are not free, there's still a contribution that we can make to our democracy. So, Professor Vincent, I'll kick it off with you. Why is it that we do have the strong link between freedom and democracy, and whether I feel free very much determines how I can view whether democracy is working or not working for me?
Thanks. Yeah, I think it's important to think about freedom as having two components or two faces, if you like. So the one aspect of freedom would be where we are not prevented from doing anything. So if I'm not prevented from speaking freely, then I have freedom of speech. Or if I'm not prevented from joining or forming a political party, then I have political freedoms and so on. But as you rightly point out, actually being able to exercise those freedoms relies on the other face of freedom, which we might call freedom too. So am I really free to do those things? We might say that I'm free to write letters to the newspaper and exercise my voice in that way. But if I'm illiterate or if I'm too hungry to be thinking about writing letters, then obviously I'm not going to be able to exercise that freedom to the same extent as another person who might have those rights in place in their life, have that access to good nutrition and housing and employment and so on. So I think what we're really talking about then is those two faces of freedom. And clearly they're both important. Nobody is saying that it's irrelevant to have these rights, the right to freedom of speech and the right to political freedom and so on. But actually being able to make those rights meaningful rely on another category of rights, which is socioeconomic rights and freedoms. It doesn't make sense to talk about having freedom of speech if someone is, you know, hungry and illiterate and so on.
Dr. van der Heerden, your take on that first question?
Yeah, no, look, Cassie, thanks for that. I agree with Prof. Vincent. I mean, it's a question of what I would say. Usually when we have this conversation, we talk of tangibles and intangibles. Tangibles are indeed, as you've indicated, and it's a measure of democracy. It's a measure of freedom, which is the tangibles is about running water, it's about electricity, energy provision, it's about food, access to schooling, primary health care, etc. And those are very good measures of wanting to determine how healthy a democracy is, because those are tangibles that in a free and democratic society, an open society, those are supposed to be accessible to all citizens in all countries. Then, of course, there's also what you and Provincent talk about, which I call the intangibles, which is as important. But the intangibles is what I would call the big issues. The as you say, political rights, socioeconomic rights, dignity, the independence. These are instruments of democracy. The independence of the legislature, the independence of the judiciary, the fact that you have independent institutions that is there to protect our democracy and the Constitution and Bill of Rights, Chapter 9 institutions, etc. Freedom of the Fourth Estate, being able to write what you like, think what you like, express yourself, and so on and so forth. Often, and perhaps this is the one controversial point I want to throw into the mix, Kathy, often the intangibles take a back seat, and it's almost as seen or forgotten as equally important than the tangibles. And I agree with Provincent. There's no point in having the intangibles when you are hungry, when you are unemployed, when you live in poverty. But I do think it's important in terms of tangibles and intangibles that we appreciate the big issues as well as the tangible issues.
All right, Dr. van Heerden, thanks for that contribution. Professor Ngomezulu.
Thank you very much, Kathy, and thanks to my colleagues. They've made my job even easier. You see, the reality here is that in most instances, we take these two terms to mean one and the same thing, when in reality, they don't. At a very surface level, if we talk about freedom in its own essence, it basically means what Prof. Vincent was saying. You have basically the right and the power to decide how to speak, what to speak, how to think, what to think, what to do, and so on and so forth. That is just a freedom. But the moment you talk about political freedom, that is a specific type of freedom which will then be be linked to governance systems, whereby then we have the right maybe to decide who your chancellor will be, who your president will be, and all of that. And then, of course, people will always say that if I have freedom to decide, therefore it means that those are put into positions have a responsibility to respond to my needs. In most cases, that does not happen. When it comes to democracy, on the other hand, as much as some features of democracy are linked to freedom, but in real sense, democracy is a system of government. In other words, if I can make an example of where the majority of African countries were under colonialism, then they got their political freedom. So basically, they were free. But then, after having obtained their freedom, they then decided on the form, the system of governance that they were going to use. Some went for multi-party states, others went for a one-party state, others went for autocratic states, and so on and so forth. So that is where then the system of governance then it dictates how you enjoy your freedom. You already have your freedom, but then that freedom is channeled through your system of governance, in this case, democracy. So I would say that is the link I can draw, of course, adding to the points that my colleagues have just made in terms of the tangible and intangible, and then the rest of other stuff that Prof. Vincent also alluded to.
So maybe let's start with some of the intangibles, as has been said in this conversation. Professor Vincent, today, and we got criticized for this in one of the previous conversations. One of the listeners says, well, actually, I think that there's too much criticism of what is happening today, and people looking at what they can't do or what they can't have access to in terms of the tangibles, that they're forgetting that there's so much that they can do, and perhaps we just take it for granted. that you can move around by and large and not be arrested. You don't have to show your IDs everywhere. And of course, you know, the general comparisons to what life was like under apartheid then come in.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right. We shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's lots of things that we might be unhappy about and lots of things that we think we're not achieving right now. But at the end of the day, I'd like to define democracy as a theory of legitimate government. So in other words, what it really is a theory saying under these circumstances, power over us is legitimate. And that's very important because it's taking us back to what has been called in this conversation, the intangibles. How do you ensure that we are governed well or governed better? And I think there's not a lot of room for debate about what we mean about being governed well. I think across the political spectrum, we can agree that we want more children to be able to read by the time they're 10. We want less mothers dying in childbirth. We want more people with access to clean water and sanitation. I think those things are agreed. Nobody's a lunatic that doesn't think that those would be markers of successful government. But how do we get to successful governance? And democracy is a theory about that. Democracy says, well, the best shot you've got at being well-governed or governed in, as my colleague said, in a way that responds to our needs is by having some control over those who have power over us. So we shouldn't forget that that is really what we have given. That's the freedom that we have. We have freedom to make choices at elections. And we have freedom to exercise our political voice, to vote for who we think might be better or best at responding to our needs and so on. So there's a circle that we need to close between the tangibles and the intangibles. And if our tangible needs are not being met at the moment, then we need to look to the ways in which we are or are not exercising those other intangible rights that we have.
Do you get a sense, Prof. Louise, that is the approach really that the majority of South Africans take and hold of democracy, simply because so many people are opting not to go and vote. So many people are choosing to not exercise that intangible right to vote.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a lot of disaffection and dissatisfaction, and maybe that relates to the choices that are available to us and a sense of alienation from the political sphere. And I think we see that with youth in particular. And there is a way in which existing political institutions like political parties feel a little bit outmoded and outdated from the perspective of the way in which especially younger people, and we know that we have a youthful population profile, especially younger people are engaging the political sphere. So when we talk about people not being engaged in politics, we can't only then use voting or not voting as a marker. I think that what I see certainly as a professor of politics is a high level of engagement on the part of youth, but not necessarily through the vote. So through social media platforms and so on. And the other thing that we see is in the move away from party politics is that people are much more interested in single issues. So rather than the whole sort of bundle that a party offers, and that is the way that party politics works, we see youthful engagers in politics being engaged in single issue, maybe environment or maybe issues of sexuality or whatever happens to disaggregate them. And social media platforms lend themselves to those forms of political engagement that are very much issue based.
Dr. Van Heerden, there is a level of dissatisfaction, and Prof. Vincent alluded to it, when it comes to the dividends of democracy, and that you have people that feel that, well, they have not reaped that dividend that was promised to them. And as a result, when they look at this conversation or this idea of being free, as long as they feel that they're not reaping the dividend, then they cannot actually say that they are free. How do we deal with that gap, right? Because the Constitution means well in the hope that it provides for South Africans. But there is the gap between what is promised versus the realization?
No, absolutely. I mean, the truth of the matter is, if I could just firstly respond to the previous point, which is that I think we should also be aware, Kathy, about the level and high percentage of turnout in the South African elections. I know that there's really pretty real concerns and about apathy and people not coming out. But when you look at other democracies in the world, in our case, about 44 million South Africans are eligible to vote, and only about 26, 27 million come out to cast their vote. But that is still a very high percentage in comparison. If you look at the turnout and apathy that's there in other democracies, and I just thought I'd park that point because we have become rather spoiled, if you like, in a positive way, about the huge numbers of people that comes out, even though it is beginning to dwindle as we go to successive elections. So just that one point. On the issue of the dividend, I mean, you know, the truth is, and you are correct, the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa is a vision. It's a visionary document. It's something that we espouse to. There are some existing tangibles and rights that are already in place, but we still need to move towards an ideal South Africa where socioeconomically people begin to feel that they are catered for, that they are looked after in the most basic forms, whether it is in terms of water, electricity, and so on, primary healthcare, schooling, and the likes. And indeed, there is this constant tussle between a governing party, for example, in South Africa, that is saying over the last 30 years, over the last three decades, a lot has been achieved with regards to some of those basic services and so on, but more needs to be done. And so, of course, there are, especially the younger generation, that, you know, have got expectations, who wants employment. It's not as if they are not skilled, by and large, not qualified. The economy is just not growing at the rate that it's required, and so on and so forth. So that I fear that deficit will remain for time to come, but slowly a successful government will slowly but surely incrementally begin to eat away of that deficit, and hopefully at some point we'll get to a point where there is a sizable black middle class in South Africa, that the structure of the economy has taken different permutations and shapes, and that there is more satisfaction with delivery.
We'll continue the conversation in a moment. It is 10:30 now. Time for your latest news headlines.
The Talking Point with Kathy Mohlahlana. Weekdays, 9 a.m. till midday.
All right, we continue the conversation on The Talking Point. It's our series of our Freedom Month series. And today we're looking at freedom versus democracy. We're joined by Professor Louise Vincent, Professor of Political Studies at Rhodes University, Dr. Oscar van Heerden, a Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Diplomacy and Leadership at the University of Johannesburg, and Professor Beki Ngomezulu, Professor of Political Science and International Relations, and also Director of the Center for the Advancement of Non-Racialism and Democracy at the Nelson Mandela University. So, Dr. van Heerden, before we into headlines, I think I may have cut you off there while you were still making the point around dealing with this deficits that exists, especially when it comes to the young people of the country, their hopes for themselves versus what is reasonably possible given the state of the economy currently.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. You know, the last point I wanted to make was that I think our youth needs to also be cognizant of the fact that it's all good and well to say the economy is not growing, but there are very real contributors and factors internationally on that scenario. It's not so much only about what the South African government can do. There are, of course, debates around interventions, different approaches, one of which is a big one, Kathy, is that there are many that argue that it's high time that we privatize the state-owned enterprises, and do what's happening with in some countries where Transnet, PRASA, Eskom, etc., should be in private hands, and that would probably ignite something within the economy, create more jobs, and so on and so forth. It is an argument. At the moment, it is being resisted, and so forth. But the point I want to make is that there are often, if we look at the 2009, 8-9 global financial crisis, which led to job losses across the board in the world, including South Africa, where more than 2 million jobs were lost. A million of that has now been sort of gained back steadily over time, but it left a huge dent within the prospects of. And then, of course, there's also these global conflicts, which I know is not the topic today. But as you know, when oil-rich countries begin to engage in conflict, it negatively impacts on the price of oil, which then trickles down to petrol price, food prices, and so forth. So these are all externalities that the ANC government are not in control of, and yet is still trying to having to manage the economy with the Reserve Bank and so on and so forth. So it's a very, very complex issue, but a very real one for people on the ground.
Prof Nkomezulu, one of the things that we're seeing now, especially given the fact that we are in the height of election season, is of course political parties campaigning, making all sorts of promises, right, to the people of this country. And a statement that one often hears is that you've got to look at what the parties are promising and then see which one is realistic and then perhaps support that party. Is there a same idea around what is realistic under democracy? What is reasonable? What can we use as a benchmark that is attainable?
Okay, thank you very much for that question. Maybe before I answer that question, let me just go back to the point you made earlier on and my colleagues commented on in terms of us having a constitution that is supposed to lead us to a particular direction. But unfortunately, we are not where we are supposed to be. And one of the challenges is that we have to breathe life into our constitution. If you look at Chapter 2 of the Constitution, for example, which enshrines the Bill of Rights and, of course, a number of other things that are listed there, and then you look at that against Chapter 9 institutions, which are supposed to ensure that there is democratic consolidation. But unfortunately, none of these two chapters of the Constitution will take us to where we want to be unless you and I breathe life into it. In other words, we make use of the institution, Chapter 9 institutions, and also we understand the rights enshrined in Chapter 2. If there is an IDP and you don't attend those IDP meetings, if there is Imbizo or is Imbizo and you don't attend, if there is a call for us as the general population to comment on certain bills that are being crafted by Parliament and we decide not to comment, so nothing is going to change. So those are some of the realities then that we have to contend with. But to come back to a point about parties making promises against what is realistic. As a matter of fact, I'm not a fan of constitutions, I mean, of manifestos. In fact, I even wrote a piece where I was saying that manifestos don't win elections. I still maintain that position, simply because there are people who would vote for a political party having not read even a single sentence in that manifesto. And in some instances, you will find that manifestos are written in foreign languages, and the majority of the people locally cannot even understand what is said there. But they still vote for that party anyway. So, in other words, the promises that are made, people will listen to those if ever during the launch of the manifesto there is a variation between English and any other language or local language, then people will get to know what is happening. Only a few political parties have their manifestos written in different languages so that they can access different constituencies. So even these promises, therefore, some of them don't reach the intended end users, the recipients, the voters. Then when it comes to realistic issues, it's very interesting that you'll find a number of these politicians saying that they are not basically challenging what the ANC has been doing since 1994. All they are saying is that they will do better. If the ANC has built 10 houses, then they promise they're going to build 20. If the ANC says that it's going to end load shedding this year, like Paul Mashatile was saying, or next year, whatever the case is, they will come and tell you that they're going to end load shedding in 6 months. So basically, in terms of being realistic, you then start to wonder, have these politicians looked at the reason why we are struggling? If the answer is yes, they've done that, are they being honest in making those promises, which they know for sure they're not going to keep? Because in a democratic order, normally what you do, if you're a good leader, you look at the challenges that the country is facing, and then you look at the possible solutions, you identify the ones that are feasible, and then you honestly tell the electorate, on this one, it's not going to take me a year, it's not going to take me 3 years, it will take me 5 years and above, simply because of the following reasons. So that shows the electorate that you did your homework, you understand what is happening, and you are being realistic. In that case, then, Democrats will be consolidated because people will trust you, you'll earn their trust, not because of what you do, but because of what you say and what you do. Because people must not necessarily listen to you and then hope that a miracle will happen. They must listen to you and then look at it from a practical point of view and then make a determination. But the bottom line is, I don't trust my ancestors. Normally, they don't achieve what they said they're going to achieve.
Mm. You know, Professor Vincent, one of the other things that I'm thinking about is just, of course, this year we're going to see, you know, the almost one of the highest numbers of elections take place globally. And much of it has put democracy in the spotlight as a system of governance. And a question we'll also hear asked a lot is whether democracy is working for South Africa. So is this democracy working for us? And where you have high levels of disillusionment, people losing faith in the system, are there ways you think we could actively be increasing the faith in democracy as a system? Is there a need to do that? Or is this just part and parcel of being in a democracy?
Yeah, absolutely, there are ways. And I think we're talking about two things again. I'd like to break it up into talking about political cultural factors. In other words, our attitudes, beliefs, norms, values as citizens and our orientations towards the political system. How tolerant are we? How robustly do we expect to engage in critique of our politicians and call people to account and so on? So what are our expectations, norms, values as citizens? And then on the other hand, there is institutional design. In other words, what do our political institutions look like? There are many different ways in which we can design institutions within a democratic framework. Not all democracies have exactly the same types of institutions. So we've opted for specific types of institutional designs, and we then need to look at the relationship between those two. So are there ways in which the norms, attitudes, beliefs, and so on, and behaviors of citizens, orientations towards the political system, are there ways in which we are affecting that through our institutional design? I'll use an example, the electoral system. So my colleague spoke about whether or not people vote for manifestos or parties and so on. And clearly, it is the electoral system itself and the way in which we have designed it, which is a specific choice and a choice that is not made by other countries necessarily. We've designed an electoral system in which citizens must vote for a party label. So we don't have a constituency system. We don't have a single person that we can say, well, I voted for you and now I'm calling you to account because you promised that you would do this and this and this in our constituency. So we've taken that measure of individual accountability out of the picture. And what we've done with the electoral system is to place in the party hands the power to choose who our representatives would be. So, and not only are people not voting for policies, they're not voting for individuals. Lots of people don't even know who is on the party list and what implications it has for an individual to be placed, you know, 30 or 300 on the party list. And so when we get our ballot, we simply get a party label and we vote for the party label. And we have to think about what the implications are. What does that mean for our capacity as citizens to be able to call to account politicians when they don't behave well. And so I think we need to recognize that this is not something about our politicians or something unique to our country or our continent. Everywhere in the world, we expect politicians to behave badly. If you don't give a human being an interest in following a certain path, if you don't make a certain path costly, then it is rational for that human being to follow the line of least resistance. So, what are we doing in our institutional design to make it more likely that we have oversight over those who rule over us? And where have those institutional oversight mechanisms failed? So we had a spectacular example in relation to state capture. And what the report says is that this is a failure on the part of the legislature to call the executive to account, to exercise oversight over the executive. But we need to take a step back from there and say, well, what was it that made our legislature so weak in relation to its oversight function over the executive? So that for me is one of the critical features that we're facing right now in institutional design, and which will determine the outcome of this work in progress that we are calling democracy. The outcome is by no means certain. We don't know if things are going to end well or very, very badly for us, but the moves that we make over the next period are going to determine that outcome. And for me, one of the absolute critical features in institutional design is when, how much oversight do we have? How strong are our committees? How well staffed and resourced are our committees? And these are the kinds of things that we're not getting a lot of public debate about. And those are the, it is in those forums that exercise over, for example, spending our taxpayers' money is determined.
Sure, so much that you've said, Professor Vincent. I guess in many ways, it's also a question of the parties, right? And the fact that it is convenient that those are the conversations we're not having, because ultimately it takes us back to where are the weaknesses in the system and where do we need to be strengthening, including the functioning of the legislative arms, such as your National Assembly. I want to bring in some of the callers that are calling into this conversation. And now I'll kick it off with Brian in Cape Town. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, Cathy, and your guests. I'd just like to go back to the definition of democracy and recommend a very interesting book by Felix Green, entitled The Enemy. And he says that for what is called, I quote, "For what is called democracy is merely the way in which privilege and power has been entrenched and created specifically to prevent fundamental change." Close quote. So that's the one point. The other point is, as we approach elections, we again realize that all the bourgeois parties, they all differ tactically. In other words, how best to manage the capitalist system. But they all agree in principle, that is, that the capitalist system must be retained or entrenched. And they actually promote it and defend it. And I'd like to also just paraphrase Rosa Luxemburg's words. She directed a statement to all capitalist regimes stating that soon the revolution will rear its head again. And proclaim to your horror that I am, I will, and I will always be. So, in other words, the capitalist system is not a true democracy. All this Pandora's box of social ills have been around since time immemorial, and it's even worsened now. In fact, Rosa Luxemburg said the capitalist system will soon reach a stage of barbarism, and we see it. I mean, this Jocelyn girl disappears, the mother poisoning her children, and human trafficking. The social ills is endless. The list is endless, and it's not getting. It gets worse. The capitalist system will never deliver. We're living in a dream world.
All right.
We think, you know, Trotsky said, you know, reformism. When you reform the capitalist system, humanity will pay a huge price, and that's basically what this is all about.
All right, Brian. Thanks for that view, Brian, out in Cape Town. Janus, you're also in Cape Town. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I would like to respond first of all to Brian because he doesn't keep talking nonsense to me. I came from the country which was governed by this Rose Luxemburg. By the way, she was Polish as well. And you cannot even describe what happened. But anyway, he got his point about my point. But my point is also, we're talking about the freedom, democracy in our election. You know, our election can be manipulated. We know that it's not perfect. The last provincial
our election cannot be manipulated.
Yes, can be.
No, can't be.
Let's say so. Okay, but now I would like to bring to maybe the panelists know the latest finding in European Union that actually Russia got influence on the elections and dictating the outcome of this election.
Of which election?
Of election in the Europe, in Poland, Slovenia, and other countries.
Okay.
So they've got agent among the European parliamentarians, and there's a special commission now in Europe to checking this influence, Russian influence in Europe. And I'm worried actually because our country is very, you know, strategic country in the world. And Russians got also interest into controlling ours.
All right, Janusz.
So I think, can they respond? Do they know about it?
Russian influence? Okay. Polanyi, you're in the Eastern Cape. Good morning.
Hi, Kathy. Your last guest, one of the academic professors, said something which made me, actually, I was happy to hear it from an academic, the issue of institutionalized design of our voting through the IEC, wherein you find that the public, that is you and I, have only one choice. As much as we call it democratic, it's like saying you must choose between an apple or an orange or a plum. In the way you do, but what the plum is made out of, which I would say whether you want it as a juice or to eat it, it is someone else's choice. Because that's exactly what is happening at the moment. You have no choice but to vote for a political party, but we as the public cannot vote for anyone in that political party so that we are able to take that person into account when they are not fulfilling their role. It takes 5 years for the public again to either think of either changing or staying with the same party. But in closing, Kathy, on my side, I just wanted to know from the academics how much of their influence on the basic education or the higher level of education in terms of drafting the education system, because until that space is fixed so that you and I or any other person learn and understand and be able to challenge the status quo, we will always be at the mercy of these political parties that take advantage of the institutionalized way of voting.
All right. Polanyi in the Eastern Cape, thanks for that. Let me go to Kimberley now. Denzel, good morning.
Good morning, Kathy. And good morning to your panelists. Kathy, there's a big hole here in Kimberley, and I'm looking at a bulldozer now where I'm standing. If I can use this, I will push all of these politicians into the big hole here in Kimberley because they are useless. There was a constitution judgment. Kathy, how did you ever heard that the constitution says parliament is accountable? It did not say the ANC, it means all of the politicians are accountable. I like your panelist, the lady speak now, she talks about responsibility and accountability. Now, because of that, a certain president, former president, asked the question in parliament, who comes first between the ANC and the people of South Africa? That's a problem. My next point is, Kathy, because of that, there's no accountability, there's no leadership, there's no oversight, there's no proper governance. We have issues where a 14-year-old lady, she walks to Mr. Price, and to get arrested. A young man, a group of people who are against salary in the KZN, that guy cannot walk around. He's in his house. Katie, a young girl goes to a school, she must pay money to get access to that school. A teacher for a job, she must pay a certain amount to get that job. Where does this come from? It comes from leadership. And it's not the ANC. It's the all of them. The judgment says all of them must be held accountable.
All right. All right. Denzel out in Kimberley. Thanks for that. So I'm looking at the time and I really want to do our guest some justice. So, Professor Vincent, because we have you up on the Zoom line and it's about to expire soon, I'm going to give you the chance just to respond to the issues raised by our listeners. And hopefully, Dr. Van Heerden and Prof. Ngomezulu will indulge me a little bit so that they then will have the opportunity to give, you know, their inputs after the 11 o'clock news. But Professor Vincent, you can go for it.
Yeah, I think obviously we are speaking within the framework of representative democracy. So we're not debating whether or not we should be having a communist system or something like that. So I'm going to just restrict myself to within the debates about representative democracy. So I want to go back to my initial point, which is that this is a theory of legitimate power. And quite a lot of the time you sort of introduced it as democracy versus freedom. And I want to just rearrange that a little bit and say that what we really are talking about is freedom as the starting point assumption of democracy. So we start with the assumption that human beings are born free and equal. If you think about the national anthem, the last line says that we'd actually live and die for freedom. And I just wonder if we ever really think about that, if we think about the extent to which freedom is something, you know, that we value so much that we would actually die for it. What does that really mean? And why? Why do we put that in the anthem as such a cornerstone? And I think the reality is that if you don't start from the assumption that human beings are born free and equal, then you can't really understand what democracy is trying to achieve. And for me, what democracy is trying to achieve is the protection of that fundamental assumption about the human being, and that is that we are free. And every incursion into our freedom needs to be justified, and the justification can only be in accordance with our own interests. So you can only justify limiting my freedom if you can show me that by doing so, you're acting in my interests. So I might give up some of my freedom, say, for example, in return for greater security or in return for greater orderliness in society and so on. But if I'm not secure, if I'm likely to be raped, killed, pillaged and so on, then what am I giving my freedom up to you in the first place for? Why am I giving you power over me? You can only justify your power if you exercise your power in my interests. So I think I just wanted to bring us back to that as a fundamental building block or starting point for democracy rather than the two being in tension with one another.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Professor Louise Vincent. We'll leave it there with you. When we come back, we'll take Dr. Oscar van Heerden and Professor Begim Ngomezulu. It's 11 o'clock. Time for the latest news.
The Talking Point with Cathy Motlatlana. Weekdays, 9 a.m. till midday.
Good morning, Cathy. You're speaking to Tembinko Simsimanga at Dube Hostel. I personally think we didn't get freedom. We got the democracy instead of freedom. We were fighting for freedom and then we were given the democracy, which is totally different from the freedom. Because when we were fighting for freedom, the first thing that we wanted is a land. We didn't get it. Now on this democracy thing, the majority is the one who has to rule. But once you done voting, the party that is majority voted by the majority, It doesn't work for the majority. It changes and work for the minority. When I'm talking about the minority, I'm talking about the capitalist, I'm talking about middle class, I'm talking about the religions and all the minority that you can think of. Then the democracy, that's what it presents. It will do nothing for the majority. It will always does things for the minority.
Good morning, Kathy. The truth is we are still dreaming to have both freedom and democracy. The reality is when our politicians talk, the reality of the truth will come out, because they talk about race. They classify us according to the skin tone. They talk, the language that they use, it's almost evil, because someone would say racism this, they will be pointing at each other, using fingers. And us as citizens, we even fear to walk in the street of Joburg because someone may be marked or killed in front of you. This is what the freedom that we are speaking about, being the opposite. Brian Mabai, Protect, and thank you.
Hi, this is Kathy, it's Doomsy from Cape Town. Freedom in South Africa can be characterized by the following scenario. Suppose these people who go around demanding for protection fee come to your house and then tell you that this house now belongs to them. And then after a struggle, they win over the house, and then they tell you you can only use but bedroom, the smallest bedroom and the smallest bathroom. You are not allowed to go anywhere else to use any of the other rooms. Then after a long protracted struggle, they then say, okay, we are now democratizing the usage of rooms. You can appoint someone who will be in charge of allocating which rooms each one can be, but you still pay rent to them. So that's the character of freedom in South Africa.
All right. So those are just more of the views of our listeners coming through on this conversation. Dr. Oscar van Heerden, thank you so much for agreeing to stay on a little bit longer. Good morning again.
Good morning, Kathy, and good morning to the listeners.
Professor Ngomezulu, thank you to you too. Good morning again.
Good morning, Ms. Kathy, and good morning to our listeners.
All right. So, Dr. van der Heerden, let me give you then the opportunity to respond just to the issues raised by our listeners towards the end of our conversation in the first hour, and, of course, more of those comments that have come through.
Thanks, Kathy. So many things to address, so little time. I think on the question, Kathy, about whether this Western democratic system is ideal for us. I recently, a few weeks ago, launched my own book, which is, I asked the question, is the party over? In relation to both the party in terms of the ANC, but also the party 30 years on, the celebration of freedom and democracy, which some of the callers are now questioning. So, and I do go into, I agree with Professor Vincent, it's not as straightforward, are we going for communism or capitalism? I think that it's quite nuanced. I think that over the last 30 years, and as I explain it in the book, through various policy choices, we've tried to dabble with concepts of being a developmental state, meaning that the role of government should be much more entrenched in the economy, or also dabbling with social democratic models where we give welfare, we provide, because there is this disconnect between employment, between poverty and inequality. So I just think that I try to explain it in the book. Now, to come to some of the specific callers, with Brian, I mean, Brian's point is that definition that he provided is a Marxist definition. And it's clear that he is advocating for something other than a capitalist system, which by and large is what we find ourselves in South Africa in terms of a Western capitalist democracy. Yannis's point is about, you know, there's been rumors and there's been talk of various countries getting involved and manipulating foreign countries' elections, but there's no such proof. The truth is that in terms of our own electoral system, our own independent electoral commission, they have demonstrated over and over that there is integrity within the system, that it is genuinely free and fair, and of course have invited various international observers, including the embassies that are based in South Africa, play an active role in observing. SADC sends representatives, the African Union sends representatives, and that besides all the other civil society in South Africa that obviously keeps a watchful eye on proceedings every 5 years. So I don't think there's going to be any talk of manipulation or anything like that. Where there are potential breaches or questions, you know, there is a system in terms of the electoral court and so forth. Kalani's point is he talks about institutions, correctly so, and he refers to this issue of electoral reform. And I think there is a general consensus, Kathy, out there in South Africa, amongst politicians, but also among civil society, that says that perhaps it is time that there is a review, a reform within the electoral process. Because remember, as Provincent was explaining, that system is a PR system. It's a proportional representative system. There are other systems that exist. And other institutional makeups that exist. And so it's about how we are going to look at it. Should we become constituency-based? Should we directly elect an individual to be president? And so on and so forth. That kind of reform is indeed required. Denzel's point about accountability, I find it a bit curious because the makeup of the system of governance or government in South Africa is such that there are the necessary accountability points. You know, the whole process of white paper, green paper, consultation with legislation, opening up to public to come in input. They are obviously in Parliament, which a lot of us don't know, but there are oversights and portfolio committees that is doing the oversight, and those things are open to the public. It's available on TV. Anyone can attend. You can demand those records and so on and so forth. So I think also in terms of the AG, the Auditor General's office, and many other offices, you know, that all play a bigger part in the ecosystem of accountability of government and parliament. And then the last three callers, Kathy, very quickly. Yes, there is a question of land appropriation. It has not necessarily been effective. There has been restitution, there has been redistribution, but the truth of the matter is there hasn't been a consistent handling of the land question, and that is an ongoing matter. Similarly with the national question, because there's also the issue that was raised about race. The race question remains front and center. We try to deny it. We try to avoid it. Many people don't want to talk about it because of our recent history of colonial settler and apartheid. But the truth of the matter is, and I agree with the caller, we shouldn't forget that particular element of race relations. And finally, the issue of crime and being safe, which is an inherent right. As Provincent explained, why should I vote for you if you are not able to give me certain rights and responsibilities? And one of which is to feel safe and to be crime free. Mm. And so the truth of the reality is that we do have mafias in various sectors of society, in the construction, in the taxi industry, and many other industries, which is becoming a blight. Right. On our safety in South Africa. And I think this remains a huge problem that must be addressed.
Dr. van der Heerden, let me thank you so much for your input. Professor Ngomezulu?
No, thanks, Kathy. Let me start off with this issue of race. Mm. Race in itself is not a problem. The problem is racism. I'm saying this because the center that I'm currently heading is dealing with those issues of racism and democracy. The moment you use race for your own benefit at the expense of other races, that is where the problem starts. But then race in itself is not a problem. The late Julius Nyerere said at one point, if you say we must all be equal, I don't dispute that. but then wait for those who are far behind to be in the same line, then you can support equality. In other words, under apartheid, blacks were at the bottom of the social hierarchy. So bring those blacks in line. Once everyone is using race, they are black and they are using race, correctly so. Once they are in line, then we can move together as a collective. So I just wanted to draw the distinction between race and racism. On the issue of land, as Temenggosi was saying, yes, indeed, land is not in the hands of the majority. We tried the willing buyer, willing seller approach. It didn't work. And now we are in the process of working some sections of Section 25 of the Constitution to try and respond to that, which then brings me to the bigger point about the need for a constitutional review. The Constitution, when it was conceptualized, first as an interim constitution in 1993, and then eventually when we adopted the current constitution in 1996. We did that in a particular political context, and that context has changed. 30 years is a long time, so it's time for us to do a constitutional review and address many of the issues that the callers have been talking about. On the point raised by Kolani, which is the role that academics are making, are playing in terms of influencing the school curriculum at basic education level. It's a pity that our politicians don't listen. I've made several comments, for example, in different forums, saying that countries like America, they still value history as a subject. Even if you're doing BCom, law, you're doing engineering, you still have to do history at least for 6 months or 1 year, because you cannot apply that in a vacuum. The mistake that we made was to invest a lot in science and technology as if you are going to apply that in a vacuum. As much as those fields are important, but you also need to understand the social political context within which you will be operating. Then the point made by Denzel about distinction between the ANC as a party and then parliament is a valid one, because normally when politicians address the masses, they pretend as if they are outsiders. Currently, we have 14 political parties represented in parliament, and when we talk about parliament, we include all of them. We are not just talking about the ANC. Then the last point about capitalism. Unfortunately, we are in a predicament here, because until 1993, the ANC was clear that on assuming power, it was going to be leading a socialist state. Then they realized at the 11th hour with the fall of communism, 1989-1990, that this is no longer a viable option. Then that is why we have capitalist policies that are not helping us. If we have challenges with this, then go back to the Constitution and review it. There is nothing that we're going to do to address the issues that callers are making until such time that we review our Constitution, because it is the apex law of the country.
All right, Prof. Ngomezulu, let me thank you for your time and your insights. And again, apologies for keeping you longer than what we had anticipated. That is Professor Begim Ngomezulu and Dr. Oscar van Heerden, all of them contributing to the conversation we started off in the first hour of the show. All right, so we are officially then wrapping up that particular conversation for the final hour today. We will be speaking to NSFAS, in particular, the spokesperson for the Department of Higher Education, about NSFAS. So do stay tuned in for that shortly.